Well, we have reached the final month of a year-long series, which I've called Meaning Matters. And I just want to remind you, if you haven't heard me hint around at it up to this point, why do a series called Meaning Matters? Like, what is it that we were trying to investigate or move around in for a while? And the simplest way of putting it is to say, at least I believe, that meaning matters. And that we live, to a certain extent, in a crisis of meaning. And it's not just like there are multiple crises, political, economic, environmental, all that is true. But mixed into all that is what I might call a crisis of meaning. Everything is, or I should say, as a culture, and really as a global culture, we're suspicious. We're suspicious of claims, of words, of statements. We don't know whom to trust. We become suspicious of institutions, and not politicians, no suspicion there, and our economic systems. And I think all of that, like tributaries, is feeding what I'm suggesting is a kind of crisis of meaning. And we don't know where to look. And in some ways, I don't mean this, none of you, of course, we're becoming much more narcissistic, that the only thing to trust is what I think and what I feel. I mean, in some ways, it makes sense. If there's a lot of mistrust out there, and I don't know whom to believe, well, I guess I can rely on my own thoughts and feelings. I say narcissistic, not in kind of a clinical definition, but the way Freud used it from the myth of Narcissus, who looks into the reflection of the pond and falls in love. We ought to be reminded of this myth from time to time. We look into the reflection of the lake, and what do we see? We see a reflection of ourselves, and we fall in love. I'll translate that to our contemporary world. We fall in love with our thoughts and our ideas and me, me, me. And by the way, this is not a, it's not like those on the left or right, that one party, if that's even the right way to put it, or disposition is more or less guilty of these things. I think someone disagrees. I think both, if there's such thing, which I'm becoming mistrustful of as red and blue, I would say both are prone to such reflection staring. Now, that's just a bit of riff on why talk about meaning. And it's been an interesting year journey for me personally. I just think the words that we've chosen have been timely. They've been interesting. We've had very interesting guests digging around in these things, asking, what do we, when we look carefully at words, like silence, that was last month, what stares back at us other than our own reflection? What do we hear through the echoes of time and through word etymology and through stories and images that enhance our understandings of these things and deepen our relationship with meaning? I think human beings crave meaning. And our desperate clinging to material possessions and social status is a very poor substitute for meaning. And we know that. Like, we know, man, if I only had a, now I can't even think of a fancy car, help me out. A Ferrari. If I only had a Ferrari, if I only had an Italian Ferrari, my life would be meaningful. We know it doesn't work that way, yet our culture just continues to offer up, you know, additional material possessions that are not only supposed to make our life easier, and happier, but meaningful. So, I'm not saying anything too surprising right this second. Which brings us to the final word, which will close out our year, which is an odd word to be wrestling with right now, and the word is sacred. And I think Rod's meditation was asking the right kinds of questions, the kinds of questions that I'd like to be asking this month. And actually, today is really just a setup for other weeks. I hope, if anything you hear over the course of just this morning, the question of what question should we be asking? What do we mean by sacred? Is anything sacred anymore? And if not, if you conclude, no, there's no such thing as a sacred, what alternative will you provide? And how does it help us relate to meaning? So that's kind of where we're heading. So let me just say a couple of maybe obvious things. I like to begin each month with just a little word etymology. What are we talking about with this word? Where does it come from? Now, the word sacred is, at least in English, comes to us via Latin. Sacre or something like that. And it means to set apart. To set apart. Which is very interesting origin. And this is true if you follow the other ancient languages. If you followed into Hebrew, for example, Greek, there are similar kinds of words that have similar meanings. To set apart. Now, think about that for a moment. In other words, part of the root of sacred is to discriminate. To set one thing over here and the other thing over there. To divide. And I don't even mean that, you know, positively or negatively right now. I just mean this and not that. And when you start, let's use another word that's often associated with the word sacred, though they have slightly different meanings. Holy. Holy also means to set apart. That's actually the technical definition of the word kodesh, I believe, in Hebrew, to set apart. So we move one thing over here, and we call it sacred or holy, and we leave other kinds of things over here. And that might strike like the modern mind, you know, in a somewhat odd way. It makes us a little bit uncomfortable. What do you mean? Some things are sacred and some things aren't? But I will say, in every culture that we know of, in every religion that we know of, you have something similar. You have objects, literature, places, like rivers and mountains, streams, certain kinds of dance, even certain types of times of year, certain buildings and the way architecture, in other words, and the way buildings are constructed, that was set apart from the ordinary. So you have this kind of divided world, the sacred and the profane. And sort of the relationship, and I don't mean profane like profanity, I just mean like ordinary is probably the better way of saying it. The sacred and the ordinary. Now, if this is true in every human culture, we want to ask something like, what's it mean? You know, why? Is this part of some grand delusion that all people in all places were deluding themselves, thinking some things were sacred and some things were not sacred, or some things were profane and some things were holy? And are we just, have we just outgrown that? I mean, these are genuine questions, and I hope you come to talk back because I'd like to hear your thoughts on some of these things. See, the modern mind, the post-Enlightenment mind, did some very interesting things that I think are maybe worth mentioning. It created a new world. I don't mean that the world itself changed, but our relationship with it changed. Post-Enlightenment. And suddenly, we began to look at the world, and we divided it up as well, but we divided it up materially between things like molecules and atoms and particles and resources. Like, if you had to guess, What is the biggest problem facing the western half of the United States right now? What would you say? Well, you would all say fire because you've been watching the news. But it's something that's related to fire. Water. So the western half of the United States is a good example of we looked at the land and the terrain and we saw resources. And we wondered, how do we divide up the Colorado River, give a certain percentage to Native Americans, a certain percentage, it's divided in two parts, by the way, to the lower half of the United States and the upper half of the United States in the West, and then a little tiny bit to Mexico. We'll give them a few little dribbles down there at the bottom. Now, that comes from a certain way of looking at the earth and land that is rooted in a kind of post-Enlightenment mentality. I'm not mocking the post-Enlightenment mentality. How many of you have been vaccinated? Oh, I probably shouldn't like. Let me ask, how many of you have been vaccinated? Do you know anyone that's been vaccinated? How's that? Do you know anyone that's been vaccinated? Okay. Hey, thank you, science. Thank you for looking carefully at how viruses move and morph and how to combat and fight such things. So, tremendous gift, we could say, of the Enlightenment, and also divided the world up differently than human cultures divided the world up for as long as we have any record of. So, something happened to our consciousness, we could say. And I think one of the contemporary problems we're facing right now when it comes to a word like sacred is something like, is anything sacred? Or is everything just particles, molecules in an indifferent collision? And how do we relate to those things? How do we relate to life? See, the job, so to speak, of calling something sacred and other things profane was to help human beings relate to the world in a certain way. And we do need to learn to relate to the world in a certain way. I'll give you a funny example, a silly example from my own childhood. Now, I went to a Baptist church growing up in Lynchburg, Virginia. And guess what? We were not allowed to wear hats in church. You know, why? You know, I mean, if I, by accident, was born into a Jewish home, I would have to wear hats in sacred buildings if I was male. I mean, it's like literally the opposite. What's going on? Why was that? And then I wasn't allowed to wear jeans in church either. Jeans were not as holy, I guess. Not as sacred. And when my parents finally lost that battle, I wasn't allowed to wear jeans with holes in them. Okay, fine, you can wear jeans, but they can't have holes in them. Now, you could say, one part of it, I mean, just as a kid, you think, this is insane. What kind of dumb game are we playing? But somewhere deep in the human experience, I think, is something like, how do we divide the world up? Are all spaces the same? Even the Baptist church, with its kind of velvet, ugly, maroon pews, horrid, in some ways, still now, walking into feels different than walking into Walmart. You know, it does. Like, and I would think, honestly, I probably would wear something different going into Walmart. I doubt if you even have to wear the no shoes, no service thing at certain Walmarts in this country. It's different. Would you agree that there's something different about that? And even as you came today, if you think about, hey, I'm getting ready to come to C3, what part of you was operating? What do I wear? How do I show up? How do I carry myself? Is this space different than the space outside? What makes this space different? If no one's in here, is it sacred? Is it sacred if people are in here? Or is it not sacred at all? Is it the same as if we just went to the bank together and did some transactions? So I'm just trying to probe some, I'm trying to get at what the question is. And really, I'm not even 100% sure what the question is. But as best I can put it, it's something like this. Is there sacred space? And if we consent to the reality of sacred space, even if it can morph and change, how then does that change our relationship to one another, or to a place, or to the earth for that matter? One of the things I'd like to suggest, this is a mere suggestion at this point, is that in addition to a crisis of meaning, I think we have a crisis when it comes to our relationship with the spiritual side of life. I don't know how else to put it. In an increasingly, again, we're getting back to divisions, sort of sacred, secular, an increasing secular environment, things like sacred places, cathedrals, hallowed ground of some sort, they strike us as odd at this point. Why are we still going to these places? Why are we protecting them? I thought it was interesting. You remember when Notre Dame was on fire? And suddenly the whole world cared about a church. And actually, billionaires who potentially are atheists were like, we must rebuild the roof. Why? You know, why? What purpose? Now you could say, well, because it's beautiful. Okay, so and then we're already in a value system here. We're beginning to play the value game. What makes something beautiful? What makes something valuable? What makes something sacred? What makes something worth preserving? Why not just tear it down and build some condos? You know, better use of space. There is actually a church in Grand Rapids in Easttown that was turned into condos. I thought, this is intriguing. Like, I'm not even really judging it necessarily, although I'm slightly judging it, which is another way of saying I'm judging it. But I just think in the long run, you know, in the long run, what does this communicate about what a culture values? Is nothing sacred? I mean, a church that people worshiped in for 100 years, some college kid is playing beer pong in right now, you know? And you could just say that's the way it is. Things turn over. I agree, things turn over. Things change. Not everything can stay the same. But I'm still trying to hover around the question, what makes something sacred? Is it even worth saying some things are sacred anymore or not? Do we say, well, human beings are sacred? If so, in what context? Are certain ethnicities sacred? Are certain people more sacred than other people? Does that make you slightly uncomfortable? You know, are certain people worth valuing over other people? And if you say, no, 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 all people are what? All people are just people, or are all people sacred? I thought of a line, actually, as Rod was reading his meditation that I thought, I was listening, but it also reminded me of something. Here's a line from Thomas Merton, one of Thomas Merton's most famous passages. Thomas Merton, he's the Cistercian monk from Kentucky, well, born in France. Whatever, was a monk in Kentucky. This is when he's in Louisville. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. What kind of vision is this? You know, there I was in the shopping district. What would happen to us if we were at the corner of 4th and Walnut? There I was in the shopping district, and I saw this person buying this and that person buying that, and I saw this race, and I saw this, and I saw someone carrying a sign that said this, and I saw another person carrying a sign that said this. It's an interesting thing that he's describing here. He said, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, and they were mine and I theirs, and that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation, like waking from a dream. That's a very strange passage to me, because it sounds like he's having a kind of mystical experience of union and of oneness. And it's also like an awakening, I'll use a word here, to a kind of sacredness on the corner of 4th and Walnut in the shopping district. But what makes it sacred? It's not like I suddenly awoke to the sacredness of the shopping district and I was just so deeply moved that Zales was having a sale on fake diamonds. And he awakes to he calls it the dream of separateness, that there is a kind of union among human beings and a kind of sacred connection between people in the midst of a profane place. That's to use the sacred secular division. The shopping district is profane, yet in this one moment, it's shot through this kind of mystical insight of union and connectedness among all human beings. So why am I mentioning that? I'm mentioning that because if we lose the conversation or the question of what does it mean to be in relationship with the sacred, I think we lose the possibility of this kind of mystical realization. Because then what are human beings to us? Molecules? Dispensable fragments of stardust in a flat and value-free environment? So anyway, wrestling with, is there anything sacred? Is a human being sacred? And then if we start to extend that out, because I think more people are comfortable with that, yeah, I'd like to, at the very least, do unto others as you would have them do unto you kind of thing. I'd like there to be a deep respect for the human being. Well, where else and what else? Like water. Have you seen the Colorado River, by the way? This body of water, which has been flowing really before even indigenous people lived here. That's amazing, really. Doing its thing, working its way, melting snow, carving canyon walls. What's our relationship going to be like with places like this, which we are really, I was going to say running into the ground. That's probably the right image for running it into the ground. But if everything is flat, value-free, nothing is sacred, what does it matter? Use it all. Who cares? YOLO, you only live once. So my point is, getting into a conversation about the sacred, I think, matters concerning our own future, concerning our relationship with land and air and water and human beings and nations and even politics and economic policy. This is the terrain. I don't think it's specialized anymore to religion. Religion got into objects, you know, like this object is sacred and that object is sacred. This is another thing that happened, you know, post-Enlightenment. We started digging this stuff up, you know. Part of my training in graduate school was in archaeology. So, you know, when you pick something up out of the ground that was sacred to a people 3,000 years ago and you don't get struck by lightning, you know, you're like, oh, well, I guess it's just a piece of clay, you know, shaped in a certain way. And on the one hand, that's true. But on the other hand, what kind of world does that leave us in? Is nothing then sacred to anybody? Or is it just a matter of narcissistic personal opinion? So these are the kinds of questions I'd like us to be wrestling with over the next few weeks. Let me add a couple stories here, which I think, I thought of three sort of stories from the Bible this morning, from the Torah, that are related to this question. Two I'll just mention in passing. Actually, what time is it? I'll just do two stories. So maybe you've heard the story of Jacob, where he goes to sleep one night on a rock, which I always thought as a kid was funny. I guess I still think it's funny. He went to sleep on a rock. Like, why? I mean, mean, why not like some get some brush or some moss or something? But anyway, he goes to sleep on a rock. He uses the rock as a pillow, and he has a dream. And in this dream, he sees a ladder. And in this ladder, there are messengers, angels of some sort, descending and ascending. It's kind of a mystical vision. You might ask, how is he even having this vision? What do we mean by vision? These kinds of things. But he wakes up and he says, God was here and I didn't know it. That's an interesting sort of realization. That's a consciousness shifting experience. It's not that God arrived here. Whatever he meant by God, I'm not sure. But we could say that he's not saying God showed up. He's saying, well, God was here and I didn't know it. That is an awakening. That's exactly what is happening to Thomas Merton on the corner of 4th and Walnut. It's a realization that I love all these people and that we're not separate. And that's what's happening to Jacob here. He experiences some kind of divine connection in this surprising place. And the place gets called Bethel, House of God, and then it becomes like a sacred site, which is how, as far as we know, all sacred sites were formed. They're rooted in experience. Somebody, somewhere, or people experienced some kind of awakening. And to honor that awakening, they said, this place is sacred. We ought to treat it differently so as to remind us what's really true. That's the point of something sacred. So it changes our relationship with the object or the person or the place. We're not just going to put, now I have Zales in my head. Is that that jewelry place? You know, Jacob doesn't wake up and say, let's put a Zales here. All right, let's sell jewelry. You know, he says, let's honor it and we'll approach it with respect and we'll remember this place and we'll remember that at one time our ancestor experienced something miraculous here, or amazing here, or connective here, or expansive, or to use modern contemporary fancy language, a shift in consciousness, an awakening. And it needs to be marked so that we don't just run it over. Okay? Here's the other story, also from the same, around the same time period. And it's the story of Moses, right? Moses, I love the story of Moses. Here's one thing I love about the story of Moses, is that he's a murderer. He murders an Egyptian. Did you know that? And later on, he gets the Ten Commandments and it says, don't murder. You know, only someone who knows what that's like can, I think, carry that thing down with a certain amount of consciousness. He can say, I know what it's like to act in such a way. Anyway, that's a total aside. Just trying to get you to like Moses, you know? Anyway, he kind of runs away and gets married, becomes a shepherd. Right? He's wandering around the wilderness. And then it says this. He sees a tree that's on fire, but it's not consumed. And he gets curious. You know, that's an odd way of putting it. He sees a tree that's on fire. It's not consumed. So he's like, what is this strange thing? And he goes over, I don't know, to check out this thing. And then he feels, hears, has some kind of experience, and a voice says, take off your shoes, you're on holy ground. This is actually, now we're directly in the terrain of the sacred, that I have to shift my relationship to a place or to an object or to life. I need to change because of this encounter in some way, and he takes off his shoes. Now, what I like about this story, well, a friend of mine, Peter Rollins, he's an Irish philosopher person, he says the point of this story is to help us move toward a greater consciousness where every tree is sacred, which is an interesting conclusion. It's like you experience something very specific somewhere, this is holy, or set apart, or sacred, changing your relationship with that place forever, to open you up to the possibility of what else is sacred, or holy, or should be treated with a certain amount of dignity and respect. Now, I like that as a kind of idea. But what happens in the modern world is we say something like, well, we don't need the specific experience. I don't need to take my shoes off anywhere. I'll just call everything sacred or everything spiritual, which is a way of saying then nothing is. And, you know, I might as well go to Zales instead of look at the sunset. It's all flat. It's a flat universe. You see, I'm picking on that word flat because I think that's a kind of the cultural place we find ourselves in. It wants to flatten everything out. And I'm saying there's something interesting about even the word sacred that is trying to create, what's the opposite of flat? Peaks and valleys. Look at this. What about this? What about this space? What about this building? What about this sunset? What about this object? What about this river? Did you know? I keep coming back to the Colorado. I don't know why it's in my mind. But when they put in one of the dams, a tribe came to offer kind of a funeral rite. That's the legend. For the river. I thought, okay, this is what an interesting relationship juxtaposition that's happening. One of the most magnificent modern feats of engineering ever, these two massive dams that sit out west, one making up Lake Mead and the other Lake Powell. From our point of view, but from the other point of view, I'm just asking questions here, it was time to grieve. That's very interesting. It raises very interesting questions about what is sacred, what makes a place sacred, and how might our relationship change to it. And if we treat everything as material only, what is lost? That's what I'm really asking today. If we lose a sense of the sacred, what is lost? What are the cultural consequences of that? Okay. I should probably look at my notes and see if there's anything I actually said that was in my notes. And if I'm missing anything that seems important. I think I'll leave it at that. I'm going to end with this reading again from Thomas Merton. In Louisville, I'm going to now interpret things. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, or here I am in Grand Haven, at the corner of 5th and Columbus, just going about my business on my way to Zales, you know? The title of today's talk is On My Way to Zales. I've never even been there. I don't even know where one is. Okay. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, minding my own business, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people. What is that? What kind of insight is that? What is flooding in to one's awareness or consciousness? Are human beings sacred in that sense? I love all these people, and they're mine and I theirs. And we could not be alien to one another, even though they were carrying signs that I disagree with. That's not really what it says. We could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness. So here's the paradox. The sacred is a conversation about to separate out, which also ironically leads us to the doorstep of some kind of deeper connection. That's the paradoxical tension of sacred. So I hope you'll stick around in the weeks to come. Thanks for listening.